I hope to present you today something about the epistolarium, indeed. I will present you today two things. First, a sketch about the process of the development of the tool itself. And secondly, a case study about co-citations which can be done with this tool. So that's two parts of this presentation. Well, first, a sketch of the project. Of course, I first have to name all the participants, but that's not that interesting. It was funded by the Dutch government, of course, and there were all kinds of people involved in this, not only my own institute where the developers worked, but also the Descartes Center of the University, Royal Library, Amsterdam University, and, of course, the data archiving network services where all the work all will be kept for the next centuries, we hope. First, the ambitions and questions of the project itself. Why did we embark on such a project? Of course, it's quite new in humanities to work with digital tools. And so the question was, how can we combine and structure different sets of letters of 17th century scholars in such a way that we can analyze and visualize the production, circulation, and use of knowledge in a wider international context? Well, this wider international context was not that wide, for we started with scholars who worked in the Netherlands. So the meaning is that we look to Europe as a whole, but, well, we start close to our home. And of course, an important question was also, can we, from the content of these letters, can we recognize the themes and stakeholders that were important at the time in the scholarly debates, and in such a way that the tool generates this, not without knowledge put in before we go at work. Well, for such work, it's required to have, of course, to have this content. And, well, as you know, making content from letters requires transcriptions. But transcription of a letter is time-consuming. And, well, we just had funding for making the tool and not making the transcription, what really is, in my view, a strange thing. But anyway, we had to work with this. And so the solution was that we looked at optical character reading of the edited correspondence of certain people, a list of people. As you see, we on this list is also not only the Dutch people, also René Descartes. In a way, we see that as a Dutch scholar, more or less, because for about two decades, and most of his philosophical, natural-philosophical work, he did it in the Netherlands. By doing this work, we came to a list of 20,000 letters. It sounds quite a lot, but it is really not that much from all the letters which are preserved, which are, well, more than 100,000, I think, for the Netherlands. And by having these optical character readings, we still had quite some problems to tackle. For all these editions, a different structure in printing. And this also meant that, of course, the languages were quite different. There were languages in Latin, English, German, French, Italian, and Dutch. And there was no uniformity in spelling in those days. There was no uniformity in the available metadata of the editions. Well, what to do with something what's not in not letters, not words, but, of course, well, very important for scholarly discourse, the figures and formulas, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of curation needed to have this input, to make it possible to input this in the epistolarium. For instance, if you look at this letter, mostly in Dutch, but also in French, but the last letter says that this is a letter of Constantijn Huygens, that with his servant he only speaks English. So in one letter, more or less, you have to tackle three languages. So what is what was required to tackle by the developers was, first of all, for the corpus, an automatic language identification. You must see what letter is in English, what is in Latin, what is in Dutch, and so on and so forth. The spelling. The computer can only work with normalized things. So we had to have some spelling normalization, which is quite difficult because every language has another requirement in this case. We have also the problem of all the Z's and O's and N's and so, and ORs. So the removal of all those not really valuable articles and conjugations were also necessary to tackle. Then, when that was done, the real work could go ahead. That is topic modeling and keyword analysis. I return on that a little bit later. First, then we had also, very important, is named entity recognition. It's very important that you can distinguish in the corpus the names of people and the names of places when you look at the circulation of knowledge and you look at the stakeholders involved. Then, when you have done that, then you can go to network analysis. And also, it's involved in this is co-citation module on which I present a case later on in this talk. And also we have, of course, several visualizations. Most of this work was done by major developer of the Huygens Institute, Dr. Walter Raveneck, and of all others, but he was the person in which it was mostly involved in this topic modeling and named entity recognition. Well, what is topic modeling? Topic modeling is when you have a document with words, a letter, for instance, you can divide it in topics. A topic is just a group of words. It could be a sentence, but can also be a part of a sentence. And when you look at a word, you can look at the co-occurrence of this word with this topic in a mathematical way, in a statistical way. And they are used to identify in the corpus similar words, comparable documents, and documents that resemble a text fragment that you can offer to the tool. And first experiments were carried out with a method called latent Dirichlet allocation. And that is a mathematical model which was proposed in 2003, 10 years ago. And that explains why some parts of the data are related. It's more or less a semantic analysis on a statistic technique. But that's well important, and that it was one of the problems that became evident later on. It disregards the mutual proximity of words, and that later on appeared to be very important. For after about 2 years' work, we came to this kind of conclusions. You get a number of words which were related to each other, which came attached a number to it. And with these numbers, you could make some graphs over time, which seems to point at interesting things. For instance, if you look at a discussion in the Hugo de Groot correspondence, Grootjes correspondence about nobility, you see that in the 1610s, it seems to be very important, and it became less important later on. But when we evaluated this about 2 years later, and we asked to 20 international historians of science during a conference, well, just try it. What do we have here? Can you use it? The answer was, well, no, I'm sorry. Just go back to work. For give me the text. I will be able myself to be, I can figure it out myself. The tool provides suggestions, but I don't recognize anything as being important. I can't recognize the words. I can't not search in a good way. So, well, it was not a happy moment, but it was a real learning moment. And of course, that's what you experience in developing things that you are not aware of. Of course. Sometimes I think, well, perhaps the American Intelligence Service already has this tool that we're searching about, but, well, they don't work on Latin and they don't work at 17th century correspondences, so I think it's really still important that we try this. So we went back to the drawing table, and experiments were done with different kind of approaches, especially what I said, the mutual proximity of words that was introduced, and that was really a big step forward. And the possibilities of how to search were enhanced, also, not only Google search, but also other kinds of searches we can see later on were introduced. More researchers like myself were introduced into the project, because more and more testing was involved for making sense of what the tool did. More frequent test sessions. It's very important to do that. because developers have really another language, speak really another language, and have also the focus on different kind of questions than the real historic researchers have. And several suggestions were followed, given by all kinds of researchers. The result is what we now have today, the epistolarium. This is the URL. And you, when you look at it and you have, for instance, a question word put in, then you can receive such a view. And by the selection, you can also go to the content of the letters. So what do we have? We have a combined corpus of letters, of these 20,000 letters. But unfortunately, in many cases, it looks still that it's too small for all kinds of questions. For instance, if you look at discussions where many other researchers are involved, which are not in the corpus, for instance, the Mersenne correspondence, we talked about it, then you miss, of course, all kinds of relations. And that's really a problem. Well, interviews was also faceted in Google search. And what's interesting is that the tool provides new suggestions. And for instance, when you look at a keyword, well, I work a lot with scientific instruments, and you see I've worked on the telescope, so I put in telescopia. And well, then when you look at that word, the tool gives at the moment from this 20,000 letters only 25 results. It's amazingly low. But when you look at the suggestions, you see that all kinds of other words are suggested. Dioptrica, that's the science that was called in the 17th century of the science of telescopes, but also all kinds of other variants of the telescope, telescopy, telescopies, telescoporion, and so forth. And you can click on it, and in this case, you can get more results. But that's the problem. The quality of the suggestions is at the moment still language dependent. For instance, if you look at the English word telescope, you get 50 results, but when you look at the suggestions, it doesn't make sense. So that's also that's a tool in progress. You see that's one of the problems we still have to tackle. And there's another problem about these kinds of questions. For instance, if you look at the word telescope, the telescope was invented in 1608. And, well, how do you name an instrument that's still not on the market, still not still there? It takes some while before a name is given to this instrument. For instance, only in the Netherlands, I have about 25 names for this instrument in the first half of the 17th century. And when you look at all these suggestions in the tool, you see it gives quite a lot of different things. And also, when you use a wildcard, it's also very important that you still you remember that if the wildcard really gives you what you are looking for. For instance, if you look at verrekijker in the Dutch, and the word verrek with the wildcard, it gives all kinds of other words which are not related to the verrekijker. And it is also with the other things. So it's really important. And of course, as a researcher, you have to be aware of it. You have to have the knowledge about it before you can reuse this tool in a good way. So it is not that obvious as it looks. And one of the things that really is needed in the development that the suggestions are given also in the different languages, that there's a connection between suggestions in different languages. And that's not the case at the moment. Well, we have also introduced the possibility for looking for related paragraphs. For instance, if you give a text, I only had this slide, from a book, for instance, you can give the sentence to the tool, and it looks for letters in the tool which probably are related to the sentence you give into the tool. It's not that good working because then you really need a lot of letters, especially because these 20,000 letters are in all these different languages. Of course, we can provide visualizations on present day map of Google. Places are all mapped in the tool with the coordinates. So the naming of the places, in which of course is also different during the ages, is also correct because you have the coordinates. We have also a visualization of a co-citation, and of course we have networks. Well, I go further to the cases. And I have a case on co-citation analysis, and that is very interesting in my view. That possibility that's really new in these kind of tools. What is a co-citation? Well, you already saw it. In short, when you have a number of persons in a paragraph, in a letter, or in a part of a letter named together, it probably about the same problem, that the persons are involved with the same problem. Not necessarily, but it can give you a clue. Well, this coincidence of naming persons together in the paragraph is quite a co-citation. For instance, if you look at a cosmological debate, you can have Copernicus and Ptolemy both together in the same letter, and of course they are not correspondents. So it makes really an interesting case. Well, the co-citation is introduced in the 1970s, and it is used as an important tool for the structure of scientific debate, especially in the more modern times. And the epistolarium, that's a nice thing, generates automatically co-citations from each paragraph in the corpus of letters. And that is possible because we have named entity recognition. The names are given. And, of course, not every person is automatically identified. So there is also, because we used edited editions, every edited edition has an index, and persons identified also in the notes. So we can use that to have really a good named entity recognition. And of course you must know, does he do the right thing? So I've looked to who the epistolarium identifies as being important in an already known debate about the discovery of the moon of Saturn and the ring structure of the ring around Saturn. And because it's very important that Christian Huygens, the Dutch scholar, was very important in this debate. He was the discoverer of the moon. He was also the one who introduced the ring structure. So this correspondence is in part of the epistolarium. So this really must work, or else the tool is not valid. So I just tested this case. This case has been studied very thoroughly by my colleague Albert van Helden in 11 papers in the years 1968 to 1996, and he's still working on a book on it. So, well, I already said it is necessary to check this already available knowledge as a research tool because it is quite complicated with different spellings and so on. So, first, a little astronomy. Saturn was first observed by Galilei. And about 1616, he saw the planet with handles at both sides. And suddenly, in 1642, these handles, which were there all the time, were disappeared. So that really generates a problem and confusion. So all kinds of astronomers in the years after 1642 are collecting observations. And all kinds of observations are there. And even Huygens, Christian Huygens, his first observation was indeed with Saturn with its handles. That's the observation below. So that was a problem. And then in the years 1655, 1659, Huygens said, well, no, I know what it is. These are not handles. It is a ring structure. And because the ring is, the planet is seen from different kinds, there's a moment that you look at the ring, and then the ring is almost invisible. And after that, you have also another moons were discovered by Cassini later on in the century, and also the separation in the ring. So there's quite a lot of discussion about Saturn in the scholarly community of the 17th century. Well, so I put in the word Saturn with a wild card in the epistolarium, and it generates 395 letters. In this period, and this period I always check, also checked it more by hand in 5-year periods, and you see indeed that most of the discussion is indeed in the 1655, because the Huygens correspondence starts about in the 1650s, and only a few items are mentioned in the years before, and also in the years later you see some, when the moons are discovered by Cassini, you see also some numbers more. So, first, the first period. The first period before Huygens was involved are 15 letters. And when you look at the correspondence, well, you see all kinds of persons you don't recognize. Hugo de Grotius, well, did he something with Saturn? Not that I know. So it was very strange. These are the correspondents again. Descartes, okay. Mersenne, okay. Huygens, Lodewijk, well, perhaps. When you look at the co-citations, you see these people. Louis XIII, King of France. None of the Astronomer stakeholders are mentioned, with the threshold taken on 10. So it's really worrying. However, when you look at the letters itself, you see that Diem Saturni is also Saturday. I wasn't aware of that before I started. So, well, okay, then you know that here's a problem, but you can tackle it by putting in the word Saturn with a wildcard and added to it not Dies Saturni or not Diem Saturni and not Diem Saturni. Well, then he skips all these things. It's also possible. Then there's remaining only 6 letters, not that much statistically. And, well, we have Galileo now, the first observer. Well, not that quite a result of being happy, but when you look at the letters also, you see that some of the early letters also use Saturn in an astrological context, and also astrochemical, of course. So the problem is here that you have far too little number of letters, small number of letters. Well, look then that to the later period, when there are much more letters. The problem, the period 1645, 1659, you see 155 letters, indeed with Kissian Huygens in the center as being the most important correspondent on this topic in our epistolarium, of course. Writing all over Europe. And looking at the co-citations now, you see these persons. When I look at the persons again in a different way, you see that all the green ones are identified by Albert van Helden as being a stakeholder in this discussion. So that's good. And there are 2 also mentioned, but these are mathematicians working on ellipses, a topic that Huygens also discussed in this period. For it was the period also that he worked on other kinds of issues, for instance, the pendulum clock was also discussed. So it's nice that we see at least this result. Observers, astronomers, go-betweens, mathematicians, all kinds of persons, as Van Helden said, were involved in discussion about Saturn. At the period later on, we have almost the same number of letters, with co-citations of these persons, and also all these persons are indeed named by Van Helden in this case. Only 2 persons are not named by Van Helden, Thevenot and Vossius, but Thevenot was the leader of a society, in an informal society in Paris before the founding of the Académie Royale des Sciences. So it was at his place that these discussions mostly were discussed. Vossius also was a very prolific writer who also was involved in Paris and the Netherlands and in England. He has a large library. He was really a go-between between a lot of astronomers and other interested people. So it looks that these people are indeed all involved in the discussion on Saturn. At a later period, you see a smaller number of letters, a smaller number of countries involved. And also, when you look at the co-citations, you have a little matching with the literature. Involved are now also Lahir, an astronomer. He could be involved in Saturn. Alhazen, that's of course an ancient astronomer. Sluze, a mathematician working on curves. And other physicists working on other topics in the 17th century. So you see that it seems that the number of letters indeed is very crucial in using this device. And of course, you only have a clue that these persons are really involved. As a scholar, you also have to go to the letters itself to make your story really going, of course. So it reveals, when you have enough number of letters, the most important players in the discussions, and in a few cases, persons which were not mentioned seems to have been involved in some way. But, like I said, you need historical expertise, or else you have a false conclusion drawn very easily, like in this cartoon. It's also not the right conclusion, I think. Anyway, a third part. What are the opportunities and the threats about this epistolarium? Well, digital tools, of course, such as epistolarium, are very important to work on. It's not very good at the moment still. It needed to improvement. But, well, you have to start, of course. 10 years ago, we didn't have Google Books, and now no one working in the history can do without. So you need these tools to work on, to provide acceleration and enlargement of the possibilities for research, and hopefully to be able to generate new questions and perhaps also new answers. Because, well, as an individual, you can't read 20,000 letters, let alone when you go to 100,000 letters. And that's the reason that is really important still to work on this. At least the tool now already gives a visual overview of the relevant stakeholders and places in some discussions when indeed the tool can generate it. When you ask a question to the tool that fits to the corpus that's in it. For, like I said, the present corpus is too small, in my view, for relevant results in most cases, even with Saturn. Another problem is, of course, is what's not digital available is missed at the moment. For instance, the wonderful Mersenne correspondence, which really is a crucial correspondence from the 17th century, it's still not digital available. And corpora like the epistolarium must really have this thing. And also, what I said, the expectation must not be too high. It still requires your own expertise and your own sense of Fingerspitzengefühl, the Germans say, what is important and what's not. And another really important thing is the maintenance. The maintenance expansion of the project, at least in the Netherlands, of these things are not satisfactorily guaranteed. For instance, when you look at DANS, the digital archiving in the Netherlands, they archive the data. But the tool works on the platform, which is now provided by the digital world. But when the platform at the lower level is changed, the software can't speak any longer with this platform. And then it doesn't function anymore. For instance, I experienced it myself in another project. We had a digital library of the Royal Academy of Arts and Sciences, which was put online in very early in 1999. It worked wonderful, but in 2007, it appeared that it failed because the company who built it had gone broke and so on, and it was not in open access. It could not be repaired, and it had to be built again, all over again. And that, of course, the data, the publications were still there, but the way to go to the publications was gone obsolete. And that's also a problem with these kinds of tools. You need to have an open access thing to the software to make it possible that it can receive updates. Of course, when you look at the metadata, it's very important that the metadata are handled in the same way, and that there are many discussions also with Oxford and Stanford and other parties involved. So there is really a great step is already made, but it was indeed not the case when we started. And so international cooperation really is required because it's a lot of work. The funds are getting slower and slower, less and less. And that's, of course, when we need to proceed in these things, we need to go ahead in an international way. The future of the project. Well, the future is in the Netherlands at the moment is really a little of a problem because funding is made. We had the government funding for the humanities, but the Department of Economics of the Netherlands have said to the department involved, well, you need to have more money involved with economic fundable things. So humanities are not really the place where at the moment the funds are going. So We need, of course, the implement of a collaboratory, that people can work together on this thing. That's very important, that you have a new interface, a new virtual research environment, which we hope to have implemented already in the beginning, but, well, work was far too much to do that already. And, of course, the very important and interesting also is to link these kind of tools to other things, like working papers. We have all the working papers, for instance, for Christian Huygens. It's wonderful work done recently by Joelle Joder to connect these working papers with the oeuvre complet, with the letters of Huygens. And then you see that really the editors of the oeuvre complet made a mess of quite something, not about the letters, but that from the 23 volumes of Huygens' oeuvre complet, 10 volumes are only the correspondence, and the other volumes are about the working papers. But the working papers, well, there's sometimes one page where five issues are named on the one page and went into five different volumes, being quantum mathematics, astronomy, mechanics, horology, and so on. And of course, not the way Huygens worked. If you want to reconstruct how scholars worked and thought and how they discussed, you have to make this connection between the working papers, if they are still there, and the correspondence. Well, for instance, in Holland, we have the working papers of Huygens, but also the working papers of Hugo Grotius. And this, it's interesting, I think, in my that we make this connection. And very interesting and promising, indeed, is also the connection between the early periodicals, because the very early periodicals are, in fact, printed letters. But, of course, the content of a letter changes when you are aware of the fact that your letter is not read only by the person you write to, but you know it is a forum for discussion on a huge scale, for much more. So what is really a change in writing, in addressing people, in addressing problems, when you go from the individual letter to the printed letter? And, of course, very important is also the adding of more metadata, but I think, personally, I like not only metadata like the Americans, but I really like the content. So making transcriptions, and, well, make them available internationally, in my view, in open access to otherwise the Epistolarium, or here early modern letters online, or elsewhere. But it's very crucial that it is made accessible for a large audience. Well, of course, there can much more to be said, and thank you.